An Iowa Supreme Court decision means hundreds of Iowans in prison have a chance to apply to get out. What does the ruling mean for minors convicted of severe crimes? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. That Iowa Supreme Court decision is just one of a number of items in the news we'll be touching on this hour. Also on the program, the disturbing story of treatment at a state juvenile home in Toledo, a Des Moines Register investigation into Iowa's missing persons list, the DOT's search for a new smartphone app that will prevent teenagers from texting while driving, an Iowa woman who tried dieting by swallowing a tapeworm, and as we wriggle our way to the end of the hour, a college football preview. That's all coming up. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, I have a fast-moving hour today for you. We want to hear about a number of items in Iowa's news, including the disturbing story of treatment at a state juvenile home in the central Iowa town of Toledo. Also, a Des Moines Register investigation we'll hear about into Iowa's missing persons list. The Department of Transportation's search for a new smartphone app that will prevent teenagers from texting while driving. In the second half hour, an Iowa woman who tried dieting by swallowing a tapeworm. Fair warning on that one. Finish up your lunch before that in our second half hour. Also in our second half hour, a college football preview. But first, hundreds of juveniles convicted of felonies could apply to have their sentences reviewed under three decisions handed down Friday by the Iowa Supreme Court. Joining us for the first few minutes to explain these decisions, Ryan Copemans is an attorney in Nymaster Goods Litigation Department, editor-in-chief of the Iowa Appellate blog On Brief in our Des Moines studio. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be back.
Get us up to date. Remind us, who is Jeffrey Ragland and why was he sent to prison?
Jeffrey Ragland was involved in 1986 in a fight that he started. And during that fight in Council Bluffs, one of his cohorts hit someone over the head with a tire iron, and killed them. Ragland pled not guilty, went to trial, was convicted of first-degree murder, and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And at the time, he was 17 years old. He challenged his sentence as unconstitutional 20-some years ago, and the Iowa Supreme Court said that this life without the possibility of parole sentence was not cruel and unusual, and they did that in about a paragraph. But fast forward now to today, and a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court said that sentences for juvenile murderers of life without the possibility of parole are unconstitutional if they are mandatory, if they're automatic, if the district court judge has no discretion to do otherwise. And at that time, Jeffrey Ragland and 37 other juvenile murderers in Iowa had been sentenced under this mandatory sentencing scheme. So Ragland's sentence would have been unconstitutional then, but Governor Branstad preemptively commuted his sentence along with the other 37 juvenile murderers to life with the possibility of parole after 60 years. Ragland then challenged that sentence as too long, and last Friday the Iowa Supreme Court agreed with him.
Mm-hmm. And on what basis did they agree? What came out in that written decision?
They said that under this U.S. Supreme Court case, Miller versus Alabama, that if you don't get parole until 60 years, that is basically a de facto life sentence. Therefore, it is still unconstitutional, and the district court was correct to resentence him, which now I believe he's up for parole after 25 years, and so he will be up for parole very soon. And that decision was unanimous, although the justices came to it from different ways, but they all agreed that this was equivalent to a life sentence and therefore unconstitutional. And, of course, the same rule will apply to the 37 other individuals who have been sentenced under this scheme.
Explain, too, there were two other decisions along with this Ragland decision handed down on Friday. They were taken together. Well, explain what these other ones were about as well.
Well, these two other decisions are actually the more important ones, and we're probably going to be seeing the effects of them for a long time. One, State v. Null, and the other, State v. Pearson. And in each case, what these defendants asked the Supreme Court to do, and these are also juvenile offenders, was to extend the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to cases, A, where the district court judge had discretion to sentence them, but still sentence them to long sentences, and B, non-life sentences. So in Null, he was convicted of first-degree murder and robbery, which carried penalties of 50 years and 25 years, and the judge used his discretion to add those two together, meaning that he had to serve a 75 sentence with the possibility of parole after 52 and a half years. The Iowa Supreme Court held in a split decision, 4-3 vote, that that sentence may indeed be unconstitutional, most likely is unconstitutional under the Iowa Constitution, and they sent it back to the district court judge for the judge to consider the fact that juveniles are, quote, different, that they are more capable of rehabilitation, that they are generally less culpable, and so that it would be rare and uncommon for a judge to be able to sentence these individuals to such long sentences under the cruel and unusual punishment clause. And in the second case, it was a case not of murder but of armed robbery where a 16 or 17-year-old woman was sentenced to 50 years with the possibility of parole after 35 years, and this court said essentially the same thing there.
Mm-hmm. So we have these, you mentioned 37 individuals in Iowa who were convicted as juveniles, first-degree murder, originally sentenced to life without parole. What will happen to them now given this decision?
Well, they'll most likely be resentenced, and of course they're all at different stages of their sentencing. You know, some are recent, some are a long time away. Most likely many of them will be up for parole very soon, so you will have parole hearings. Families will come in. They'll talk about how this has affected them. You will get letters of support, all these other things from the juvenile offenders to say whether they've rehabilitated themselves, whether they should be set free.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that this decision comes during a national debate over the wisdom of tough sentencing laws, many of them passed in the 80s and 90s. We had last week the Attorney General, Eric Holder, announcing he would stop seeking long mandatory sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. It's an interesting context in which we find this decision, isn't it?
Very much so. But we also can't forget, though, that there's two separate questions here. One, what is proper sentencing policy? And two, what is constitutionally required? You know, just because something is constitutional doesn't make it good policy, doesn't mean we should do it. And also just because something is bad policy, that doesn't necessarily make it unconstitutional. In this area, those two things seem to blend together a little bit in the press and also even sometimes in the decisions. You know, of course, what Eric Holder is talking about is a pure matter of policy. And now as we turn back to Iowa, what these three decisions are really going to do here is they're going to handcuff the legislature a little bit on what the legislature can do as the policymaking body in setting sentences. We're going to see a lot more discretion in district court judges, and we're going to see a lot more appeals of juvenile sentences because of this.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, before we have to go, what does it mean for the governor? Anything?
Well, very little. His commutation power is still intact. The court didn't touch that at all. It does mean in this case that his attempt to keep these juveniles in prison as long as possible, given what the legislature had originally set for the policy, that's, of course, been undone. But it's very little effect, and it won't go beyond this case.
Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ryan Kopmans is an attorney in Nyemaster Goods Litigation Department. He's also editor-in-chief of the Iowa appellate blog On Brief. And this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you're along for the ride over the noon hour here on River to River. The Iowa Juvenile Home in the central Iowa town of Toledo is a state-run facility that provides housing, schooling, and treatment to children with behavioral issues. Now, it was last November that investigators from Disability Rights Iowa discovered there three teenage girls living in a row of small concrete block isolation cells located in the basement of this juvenile home's main building. Joining us now to discuss the latest developments in this disturbing case, Clark Kaufman is a reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Clark.
Hi, how are you?
Tell us a little bit about the children that live at the Iowa Juvenile Home in Toledo. Who are they? Why are they there?
Well, there are roughly 50 or so youths there. Most of them are girls. Most of them are there not because of criminal actions or delinquency actions, as they're called in juvenile court, but because they have a history of abuse or neglect in their own past. So they're there on what they call child in need of assistance petitions or China petitions. So these are kids basically between the ages of 12 and 17 who have some of them a long, horrific history of physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, that kind of thing. And the juvenile home is often described as the last stop for kids in this position because they've been through multiple foster home placements and sometimes other state facilities. And they have issues, behavioral issues, of course, that you would expect with any child who's gone through that kind of trauma. And the Iowa Juvenile Home is set up basically to provide education and housing and treatment for them.
Mm-hmm. It was last November, as I mentioned, that the Disability Rights Iowa discovered these three teenage girls in these isolation cells. Give us some details there about the discoveries here.
Well, one of the girls who was in her mid-teens had been there close to a year, about 11 months at that point. Within a few weeks, Disability Rights Iowa was successful in securing her release as well as the release of the two other girls. The two other girls had been there for 2 months. In these concrete block cells. And one of those girls we know was 13 at the time. So when Disability Rights Iowa found out about this, they literally almost just sort of stumbled upon it during what they thought was going to be sort of a routine investigation or check of the home. When they found out about it, they immediately launched a more intensive investigation as to what this practice entailed and how long it had been going on. And that investigation still continues to this day.
What are you hearing? What is being given as possible justification for this type of treatment for children who've already had a long history of abuse?
We haven't heard much in the way of justification. It seems to be, from what Disability Rights Iowa has been able to figure out, it seems to have simply been a longstanding practice that eventually sort of just became the practice there. It actually violates the home's own policies, and in some cases, the long-term isolation actually violated court orders. But it seems to have been done for a combination of reasons. In some cases, kids who simply couldn't get along well with some of their peers in the cottages on campus would ask to go to the isolation cell simply because it was the only place where they could be by themselves for a short period of time. But in terms of the long-term isolation, it seems to have been almost done for the convenience of the staff. It does provide, obviously, an extra measure of control, but, of course, the mental health effects of it are why the practice is basically prohibited.
Mm-hmm. This Iowa Juvenile Home in Toledo is run by the Department of Human Services. What has happened? Has there been any repercussions for the people who run this home or in the DHS?
No, there haven't been. You know, one of the questions we've had for the governor is how it is that the higher-ups at DHS either were unaware of this practice, which we know has gone on for at least 17 years, or was it the situation where they were aware of it and simply allowed it to go on? The juvenile home did provide monthly reports that included data on the use of restraints and seclusion to the DHS central office. But whether or not the people at the central office were connecting all the dots and were fully aware of what was going on, we don't know.
So this may be, as we continue on the line, of a question of who knew what when.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Charles Palmer, the director of DHS, has said just recently that he really only became fully aware that this was going on in the immediate aftermath of the DRI investigation, which would have been last November. The governor has said he only became aware of the matter, very recently, apparently meaning within the past several weeks since we started publishing some of these stories. So there are some real questions about the communication between the home to the DHS central office, and then from DHS central office to the governor's office, too.
Just this morning, Governor Branstad signed an executive order immediately implementing higher standards for care and training at the Iowa Juvenile Home. What can you tell us about this latest action by the governor?
Well, some of the standards are, in essence, what the home was supposed to be complying with all along. But the The executive order does go a step further in terms of holding the state-run juvenile home to the same higher standards that the state has always imposed on the privately run facilities. The juvenile home has been exempted from some of the requirements, staffing requirements, and seclusion and restraint requirements that are imposed on private facilities. And this executive order appears to change that and sort of level the playing field. The other thing it does is it calls for trauma-informed care so that the care that these kids receive is mindful and contemplates the history of these kids. And it also calls for the formation of a panel to review various incidents and complaints at the home. What's notable about this is Disability Rights Iowa has recommended all of these changes in the past. And with regard to this panel, they had argued that they should have a seat at the table so that there would be sort of an independent outside entity as part of this review process. But at least for this particular panel, DRI is excluded from any participation.
Okay, I can only imagine we'll hear further updates about this as we get more into the investigation, and this is not the last stop in this story. Clark Kaufman, thank you very much. Reporter for the Des Moines Register, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're jumping around this hour to talk about a number of items in Iowa news today. And as it turns out, a number of the news items involve the youth of our state. Here's another item that does. The Iowa Department of Transportation is currently looking for a developer for a smartphone app that will discourage texting by drivers, especially teenage drivers. Now, they're hoping the app will be ready for release by the spring of 2014. Mark Lowe is with us, director of the Motor Vehicle Division at the Iowa DOT. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. What can you tell us at this point about this app yet to be developed, how it will work?
Yeah, and I think you said the key phrase, yet to be developed. So everything we're talking about is anticipated, but we think it's very realistic based on what we know about existing technology and things that are already in development that we can leverage. But its basic premise is that using the GPS portion of a smartphone or mobile device, it will detect when the device is moving at a driving speed, and at that point, it will lock out incoming text messages and block the person from sending outgoing text messages. And anytime it receives an incoming text message, it'll respond with a custom message that will say something along the lines of, "I'm driving right now, and I'll respond later."
Okay. So at this point, this is on your wish list of what we want this app to do. And what, you're getting bids from companies to do this?
Yeah, exactly. We've put out an RFP that has very specific deliverables. RFP is a request for proposals, and we will go through a competitive bidding process with vendors to come up with a vendor that can deliver this for us. And our hope is that we get into development yet this fall and have this ready to be released next spring.
Will the app then be free for parents, for example?
Yeah. Now, there's an interesting piece about the app, and this influences the cost and how we'll manage that. You know, the app itself, I think anybody can download, but there's a piece for parents or anybody that wants to do this that will say that, you know, in addition to just handling the blocking of text messages, it's also going to provide a report in a secure parent portal that shows where the child drove and how they performed during that time. So it will be able to tell them whether or not they were speeding on any given segment of roadway, whether or not they had hard and sudden stops, whether they went through stop signs, that type of thing, and also push message notifications when there's an unusually dangerous event like speeding of 10 miles an hour or more for more than 30 seconds, or speeding for any period of time of 25 miles an hour or greater. And so that piece has some expense to manage, and so for Iowa drivers that are 14 to 17, we're going to pick up that monthly expense, and for other folks that want to access it outside that time range, then they will absorb that monthly fee.
What do you think is the potential impact of such a technology if it has the desired outcome?
Well, I think really the potential impact is not only that we reduce accidents involving texting while driving, especially among teens, but we really start to develop long-term habits, which really has long-term effect.
Mm-hmm. You know, as the father of several teens, I'm a little bit concerned, and I'm sure your staff has thought about this too, how tech-savvy teens are and how they find workarounds and hacks for any technology that's trying to prevent them from doing something.
Yeah. Well, and actually, you know, I've got an 18, 16, 14, and 12, so I'm right there with you on that thought process.
All right.
But, you know, one of the other key provisions in terms of pushing parent notifications is the teen can switch to a passenger mode, because sometimes they're going to be a passenger, but that's going to push a notification to the parent. And by the same token, if the teen wants to take the app off, they certainly can, but that's going to push a notification to the parent. And so we don't want to get between the child and the parent, but we want the parent to have relevant information, whether it's about their driving behavior or the choice to use or not use the app, so they can have their own dialogue with their child, because we think that's one of the most important things that influence in their behavior is the ability to engage with their child and have a relevant dialogue with them about it.
Mm-hmm. You talked about talking with teens. How about texting and driving? How do you do that? What's the best way?
Well, I mentioned I've got several myself.
There you go.
And it probably varies for me with each one of them. But I think one of the key things that we see is parents are great influencers of how children drive. And if you think about it, you know, from their earliest memories, they've probably been sitting in the back of your car watching you drive. And so one of the first things we think is important is to lead by example. So if parents can refrain from that behavior, and if parents are using apps like this and you know, really demonstrating by leading, we think that's one of the most important things. One thing I've been recommending recently, too, there is a tremendous new documentary about texting while driving.
Yes, this is the one by Werner Herzog, and we heard about it on public radio a few days ago. Yeah,
yes,
this is
exactly one second to the next, and I think it's great. I just sat down with my kids, a couple of my kids, and watched it, and I didn't have to say much when we watched that, but it again promotes the opportunity to have that conversation.
And it's really, I think, one case that was brought out is the teens can actually be the leaders here. There was one example, I think, in that film, the kids saying, I think it was the mother in this case, always texting while driving, and said, "I will not get in that car unless you promise never to text while driving."
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, what I saw, too, over the years, if you remember the evolution of wearing seatbelts, there was a long evolution there as people bought into it. But I noticed that my kids today would be horrified if the car ever moved without them being in a seatbelt. And so their attitude has clearly been embedded over time. And, you know, that's one of the hopes that we would have with texting while driving, is that as we drive this message with teens, they will really become the drivers of the message.
Right. So just like we look back at the cars of the 50s and 60s and say, hey, there weren't any seatbelts in these cars.
Exactly.
And then the kids in decades to come will say, can you believe at the beginning of the 21st century, they drove around and were texting at the same time?
Exactly.
Now, remind us again, Mark, how dangerous is it, and statistically, because there's been a lot of studies on this, to text while you're driving?
Yeah, well, a couple of things that I always cite, you know, your chance of being involved in a motor vehicle crash increases by 23 times if you're texting while driving.
23 times. Think about that. Yeah.
It's very equivalent to being significantly intoxicated while driving. And one of the things that I always point out to people, if you're driving, you know, highway speed, let's say 60 miles an hour, you're traveling 88 feet per second. So in the average time it takes to send a text message, you've covered more than the length of a football field without ever looking at the road. And there's a lot that can happen in that period at highway speed.
Okay, we'll leave it with that thought. Mark Lowe, Director of the Motor Vehicle Division at the Iowa Department of Transportation. Thanks for your time today, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after a short break, a Des Moines Register investigation into Iowa's missing persons list, an Iowa woman who tried dieting by swallowing a tapeworm, and a college football preview. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. If you just joined us, this is what we call affectionately a popcorn edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Popcorn, an hour when we pop quickly from one news conversation to the next. According to an article in the Des Moines Register, 350 people will be on Iowa's missing persons list on any given day. On any given day. But some of those cases are quickly resolved. In fact, most of them, children might be found hiding, or adults are found to have neglected to notify friends or family of time away. But the Des Moines Register is also reporting some shortfalls in the way missing persons are investigated. joining us to tell us a little bit about the investigation. Des Moines Register reporter Jason Noble, he's one of the authors of that news investigation, and he joins us in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
Doing well. Tell us about this missing person list. What is it?
Sure. Basically, what it is it's called the Missing Person Information Clearinghouse, and it's maintained by the State Department of Public Safety, but it's drawn from missing person reports from agencies, sheriff's office, police departments all across the state. And so it's data that has come into the local law enforcement and has been sort of opened as an investigation there, but then is compiled statewide and actually broadcast out nationwide on a national police database too.
So there's one in Iowa, there's one central database, and then that's connected with a national database. Help me picture that.
That's right. Yeah, it's you got the state level and then the national level. So then if, say, a runaway runs away from Davenport and ends up on I-80 in Illinois and gets picked up by a police officer there, they're going to be able to punch that name into their computer system and see, oh, that person's been reported missing from Iowa.
This is astounding, the statistic, 350 people on average on any given day. That's surprising. Was it to you?
Yeah, it was. And that's kind of where this story came from. You know, we did a lot of reporting this spring about Kathleen Shepard, the teenager from Dayton who was missing and later found killed. And that sort of brought up this question of missing persons in our mind. And we wanted to see, you know, what are the cases beyond those really headline-grabbing ones? And so we got access to this database, which is actually available online every day, and just sort of started pouring through it. And yeah, you get more than 5,000 cases every year, and at any given time you're going to see 350 open missing person cases on there.
Now, your Des Moines Register investigation was critical of some of the ways in which this process is carried out. Tell us some of the flaws you found.
Sure. And what it is, you know, you're working with who knows how many dozens or hundreds of individual agencies all across the state, and they all do these investigations a little differently, and they bring a different level of sort of seriousness to it as well. The biggest issue, I think, is that there are just so many cases that come in, and so many of them are very quickly resolved. As we noted in the story, 85 or more percent of these cases are getting resolved within a month. And like you said at the opening of this segment here, a lot of them are just when runaway teens come home or when kids are found hiding under the bed. And that really blunts law enforcement's response to it, because there's sort of this natural inclination to believe, oh, this isn't that serious, they'll come home. And that's true in most cases, but then there's sometimes where, you know, you're talking about the most wrenching sort of cases imaginable.
Right, and imagine in the position of a law enforcement person, if you have such a high degree of chance it's going to be easily resolved and something harmless, then it's hard to be ready for each case to be a potential one that's really one we need to act on quickly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about all the demands that are placed on police departments to respond to violent crime immediately, to respond to who knows what on a minute-by-minute basis, you know, to devote resources to, say, a runaway who's run away from a youth shelter and done it three times already this month.
Mm-hmm. You also found that, of course, missing people can be not just children but adults, and they are handled a little differently or treated a little differently.
Well, I'd say the sort of cutoff in the way that cases are treated is between young children and then teenagers to adults. And what we found was really when you get to be a 14, 15-year-old or older up into adults that are missing, unless there's a really compelling reason to believe that they're in immediate danger, the response is pretty lax. And, you know, we've found police reports and cases where the follow-up from law enforcement might be a phone call to relatives every few months, saying, you know, have they turned up yet? And not seeing a lot of investigation beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And the reason for this?
I think it's a resource thing. The police have a lot of other demands on them, and these cases sort of slip by them.
Mm-hmm. This huge database, a statewide database of missing people, is, your investigation found, often out of date. How out of date?
Well, it's hard to have sort of a blanket statement for that, but we did some sort of case-by-case checks. We looked at 25 separate open missing person cases from the city of Davenport, and we did this in mid-July. There were 25 of them. We found that 14 instances, those cases actually were resolved and the case had not been updated. And that may have been because, you know, a law enforcement official went in to recode the case file to say case closed, this person's been found, and that just didn't get updated to the database for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Or it might be that it had been such a long time since the police had checked in that what happened was they went and checked in response to our inquiry about the case, got a live person on the end of the phone, and that person said, oh, yeah, they came home whatever day, mm-hmm. maybe just a few days after the initial disappearance.
Do you have a sense of the response that you've had, that you've caused with this investigation by the Des Moines Register? I suppose all levels of authority, local and statewide authorities, have they said anything to you? Do you think this is a spur in any way?
Well, I certainly hope it is. I will say I haven't heard anything directly from law enforcement since the story came out. But in talking with state authorities, you know, the DPS officials who maintain this database, they're really sensitive to this. And they're especially looking at it through the lens of human trafficking, which is a big initiative that the state is trying to address right now, which is, you know, where vulnerable individuals are forced into prostitution or forced labor, mm-hmm. and runaways are seen as particularly at risk for this. And so the state is really pushing local law enforcement to pay more attention to their runaway cases, to their missing person cases, because there's a good chance that they could end up in some really awful human trafficking situations.
And Jason Noble, where does your reporting on this go from here, you think?
You know, I'm not sure. There's always follow-up that can be done on these cases. Some of them have been open for years, if not decades. I think it's certainly a hope of ours that just getting some of these stories out there, getting pictures out there on the front page of the paper might spur some people to come to authorities to recognize, oh, I know where that person is, or I have some information about that case, and it might sort of shake loose some of these long-term missing cases.
Thanks for updating this on your investigation there at the Des Moines Register. Reporter Jason Noble, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and I want to beg your pardon in advance. You know, this is a news talk show. It happens to take place over the noon lunch hour, and some of our news is, well, a bit revolting, like this next item. Joining me now to talk about it, Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, the medical director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Welcome back to our program, Dr. Quinlisk.
Thanks for having me.
You were recently contacted by an Iowa doctor who had a rather curious, very disturbing problem with a patient. Can you tell us what it was?
Well, the patient had told him that in order to lose weight, she had gone online on the internet and had found a place that would sell her basically a pill that contained a tapeworm. And she had then ordered it, gotten it, ingested it, and now I guess was having some second thoughts. So the physician was calling us to say what needs to be done about this.
So you can actually buy tapeworm eggs or larvae or whatever you would actually eat? Is this an accepted dietary method?
It's not at all. It's very dangerous, and I don't believe it's legal, but I do understand that there are other countries where this is something you can get your hands on.
Mm-hmm. What happens when one swallows a tapeworm?
Well, basically, you swallow it, and it attaches to your intestine, and then it starts growing. The tapeworm itself can grow up to 30-some feet long. Obviously, it's very large. It's about an inch wide and, again, 30 feet long, and it does two things. It obviously causes you to have some malabsorption of food. It also can give you a loss of appetite, and in that way, can cause some people to lose weight, but what people don't understand is it can also cause a lot of other problems, obviously, with your intestine, and can cause pretty significant things, even rare deaths in some circumstances.
How do you get rid of it?
Well, fortunately, there are medicines that you can take to get rid of this worm. Depends on which type of tapeworm you have. But you take a medicine that causes the worm to let go, and then you pass the worm out of your body.
Mm-hmm. How did it turn out for this woman who contacted the doctor who contacted you?
Well, we did recommend that she take the medicine. I assume that that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. I understand this little item on the tapeworm diet has kept you quite busy over the last few days. Media around the world interested in this story.
Yeah, we were pretty surprised. I mean, we put out a electronic newsletter every Friday to public health officials and healthcare providers around the state just to let them know what's happening in the state. And we put this in more of a kind of thing of warning people this may happen with patients you see or people you see. Just be aware that this can happen, because we weren't aware that you could get these things off the internet. And then it sort of, as they said, went viral. So it's been something that sort of surprised us at how interested people are in this topic.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think part of it is like most people, there's always an interest in how can I lose weight and become healthier, et cetera. But then there's also this incredible ick factor of how do you even think about deliberately getting a worm that may be 30 feet long in your gut. And then part of it is that, you know, would somebody really do this? So I think it had a number of things that made people somewhat interested in it.
Okay, Dr. Patricia Quinlis, thank you for telling us this story, and keep away from those tapeworms, even if you want to lose weight. Thank you very much for talking with us, the medical director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I have the appetite for something completely different to end the show. How about sports? Mike Halas is with us, sports columnist at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Mike.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Let's have you get us up to date as we enter the college sports season for football. Let's start with the Hawkeyes. Their first game is in about a week and a half. What can you tell us about the team and the schedule?
Well, for a change, the season starts out with kind of a bang. Normally, Iowa plays an opening opponent at home that everyone's pretty confident it's going to handle. This year, it's something different. This year, it's Northern Illinois, which in many years past would have been considered one of those teams that you handle. But Northern Illinois had a banner year last year, won 11 games, went to the Orange Bowl, was a national story, and they have a premier quarterback returning. So Iowa gets a good game right out of the chute.
Okay, and that game, so what does the rest of the schedule look like?
Well, you've got Iowa State also in the non-conference portion, and a couple of other games that you ought to win at home. And you go into the Big Ten schedule, and it's harder theoretically than it's been the last 2 years, because Ohio State and Wisconsin, two of the conference's powerhouses, were off Iowa's schedule the last 2 years. They're both on this year. And so a hard enough Big Ten schedule for Iowa becomes, I think, very hard. So a team that went 4-8 last year may not dramatically have a better record this year, even if it is noticeably better.
Mm-hmm. So every year people try to predict what will happen with any football team, with the Hawkeyes, no exception there. Can we make any predictions at this stage?
Well, you can make any predictions you want to.
Okay.
In fact, interestingly enough, I guess, today, Stuart Mandel of Sports Illustrated came out with his projections for all 12 Big Ten teams. He gave one-loss records assigned to each of them. He says Iowa's going to go 4-8 overall, 1-7 in the Big Ten. And the last time I saw anybody give Iowa preseason prediction that glum would have been about the year 2000 or 2001. And here we are in 2013, and that's because the team went 4-8 last year and had a lot of people at season's end thinking that they're kind of spinning their wheels down there in Iowa City.
Right. Is this the same Sports Illustrated columnist who wrote that Hawkeye coach Kirk Ferentz is the worst in college football?
One of the five.
One of the five. This is the same fellow.
Now I would have to look that up because it's either Stuart Mandel or Andy Staples. They're their two primary college football guys.
Okay.
But it's the same publication.
Here's a question I see. A lot of carping about Kirk Ferentz's performance as of late. Here's a headline that asks the question. I want to ask it of you. Iowa's $4 million head coach just went 4-8. This is after last season, without much help on the way. So why is his job status so secure?
He has a contract. He has a contract for that much money, and that's job security, you know?
Yep.
You had a contract for another X number of years at $3.7 million or so per, I think you'd feel pretty secure. But also, it's beyond that, common sense. There's a body of work and a lot of goodwill that's been banked. So if he had stepped off the plane and come to Iowa City, and this is as good as it's been for Iowa, he'd be on thin ice. But they've been to BCS bowl games. They've won a couple Big Ten titles. They've been to a lot of January bowls. They finished in the top 10 of the final AP rankings four times. So there is a certain amount of faith. Now, not everybody shares it because it's a what have you done for me lately mentality in sports, just like in life. But the man has shown that he certainly has the capability to lead winning programs. The question is, will there be an encore?
We'll find out. Let's pivot over to Cyclone land. What about Iowa State this year in the football?
Very hard for me to say. They were 6-7 last year, went to a bowl game and lost, but exceeded expectations. And that's what they've done under Paul Rhodes.
How do they end up being the underdog almost every year and then exceeding expectations? That's actually a good position to be in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Although I think at some point you'd like to be on the other side. You'd like to be the one that they say that team ought to be really good. And then you try and live up to that. But they're in the Big 12, which is a football conference. I mean, it's got powers. It's got the most explosive offenses in America, and Iowa State hasn't had a particularly good team defense. So that's a bad brew. But you're talking about programs like Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas State. Baylor has emerged as a really fine offensive force. Oklahoma State is a standout program. And they added West Virginia and TCU last year, which are both regarded as top 25 programs. So Iowa State is pushing the piano up a hill, really, in football. And until they break on through to the other side, they're always going to be picked eighth, ninth place at the beginning of the season. What they do have going for them, though, is that they have magical moments in the bank under Paul Rhodes. They beat Texas in Austin. They beat Oklahoma State on national TV when Oklahoma State was, I think, ranked second or third in the country. And I believe I read this, that Alabama and Iowa State are the only two teams in the country that have beaten ranked teams on the road the last 3 years. Now, the difference is Alabama strings wins like that together weekly, of course. Iowa State, it's hither and yon. But it's a program that has really made strides. They've broken their record for season ticket sales again this season. They've sold out their student season tickets. They've sort of transformed the football stadium and made it a more fan-friendly place. And there's a lot of satisfaction in the Cyclone fan base about the football program. But like everything else, things plateau if you don't build on it. So that's what we're going to what we'll try and see here is, can Iowa State take where it's gone under Paul Rhodes and go to yet another higher level?
Mike Kloss, before we have to go, very quickly, we had in the news this morning, I think caught a lot of people by surprise, former Hawkeye player Pierre Pierce in the news. Very quickly, what happened there?
What happened is Iowa playing on a six-game summer basketball trip in England and France, and shows up for a game in Toulon, France yesterday, and lo and behold, Pierre Pierce is on the roster of the visiting team. This wasn't anything that Iowa knew about in advance. Despite what conspiracy theorists might tell you, they showed up, there was Pierce, and there are people out there I know who thought that Iowa shouldn't be playing a game against Pierre Pierce, but I don't know how in the world you would have told your hosts, we're not going to play this game. So they played the game. And as luck would have it, Pierce led the game in scoring, and he scored the game-winning basket in the final seconds.
Okay. A sweet turn of irony for this end of our sports conversation. Mike Loss, thank you. Sports columnist at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. We appreciate you spending some time with us, Mike.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, Politics Day, reconciliation, military rule, or civil war, three possible paths for Egypt. Tomorrow, we'll discuss the helplessness of the U.S. in the face of the Egyptian crisis and other recent foreign policy challenges. Politics Day next time tomorrow on the program. Stefan Schmidt back on our program tomorrow. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury in Des Moines. Help from John Pemble. Also help from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.